We looked at BCFW yesterday, and so now you all know at least how to write down all tree amplitudes in a variety of theories, certainly in Yang-Mills and also in principle in gravity. How many of you went ahead and rederived the Park-Taylor formula using BCFW? Okay. Did anyone do any of the other exercises? Okay.
Not as very disappointing.
Guards.
But you know, it's they're not graded, but it's for your benefit. So. Okay. So, and then we started to talk about unitarity. We introduced the basic idea of the Kakuski rule, which is the idea of cutting a propagator, namely taking 1 over L squared minus M squared plus I epsilon, Feynman I epsilon, and replacing it by minus 2 pi I times a positive energy on shell delta function, again, as a reminder, that's putting the particle on shell. There are two solutions, and we take the positive energy solution. We have a pictorial representation of that at one loop. Here I'm actually going clockwise rather than counterclockwise, which is the more usual convention. So we're going to call this K. And again, that's the sum of momenta running from A to B cyclically and inclusively. So the discontinuity of this object in the k-squared channel is something that we can express diagrammatically. Let me do this way. And then so if we have a momentum labeled L here, then we would have, well, this is going to be L minus K going in, minus L plus K L minus K going in that direction. So now what we actually want to do is to write out the formula for this object, and then we can impose the cut condition. So at the moment, we're just working in four dimensions. We have the usual loop measure, and as advertised last time, I'm going to suppress the Feynman I epsilons in most of the discussion. So we just take the propagators going around, and we would have, let's say, let me put the momentum going the other direction here. Let's go in the other direction for a change. So we have L minus K A squared minus M squared, and then all the other propagators, and then we have the other propagators on the other side. In particular, we have L minus K squared, the one over here, or I should say referring to the diagram over here, minus M squared, and then L minus K plus K B plus 1 squared and so on. So the next thing we want to do is to actually apply the cut. Most of these propagators are going to be left untouched, but we're going to replace two of them by on-shell delta functions. So 2 pi and not worry about the i's, times theta L naught, and 2 pi times delta of L minus k squared minus m squared theta minus L naught plus k naught. So let's actually do a little bit of relabeling. Let's call LP1 and call minus L plus K P2. And we're going to then also introduce a delta function to, because these are seemingly independent variables, we can introduce a delta function of the form P1 plus P2 minus K and an extra integral over. So I'm just putting in the identity via an integral over P2. And when we do that, we can see that our integral now has the form d4p1 over 2 pi to the fourth. That's just the original loop integral. And there's a d4p2 over 2 pi to the fourth. There's a delta of p1 squared minus m squared theta of p1 naught. Delta of p2 squared minus m squared theta of p2 naught. And there's our energy momentum conserving delta function. And we have all the propagators that we had before. So I won't write them out here, p1 squared minus m squared, p1 minus minus ka squared minus m squared, and so on and so forth. So the question is, how many people here remember from their field theory course what the object on the first line is? No, you don't count. How many students remember?
Student of life.
OK, a few people remember. So what this thing is in fact just the Lorentz invariant phase space measure. So it's exactly what you would integrate over if you're trying to compute total cross-section, if you're trying to compute some differential cross-section, you'd stick in further delta functions. And the propagators that we have are just the propagators from the inside of each of these diagrams. So the object that we have here, written in a somewhat more abstract notation, is the Lorentz invariant phase space measure of the integral of a tree diagram on the left-hand side multiplied by really the complex conjugate of the tree diagram on the right-hand side. But as promised, I'm not going to be careful about the complex conjugation. So that's just the translation into a concrete formula of that S matrix identity that we wrote down in yesterday's lecture. Unlike that identity, which is, I mean, you can stare at it and it gives you a nice warm fuzzy feeling, this is actually something you can calculate with. So we've gone from an idea to a formula. So that's progress. However, there's a number of problems that we encounter. So again, we have a one loop object and we can actually calculate something about it. First of all, the problem is that this is still diagram by diagram. And we know that diagrams are bad, or at least Feynman diagrams are bad. Another issue is that here, everything involves massive internal particles, and what we really want to be playing with are massless internal particles. And the reason that massless particles are complicated, more complicated, is that there are all sorts of divergences that are associated with them. So we need to think about that. We won't really have time to go into the structure of those divergences, but I'll try and say a few words just to motivate them. You, in a sense, already know a lot about them because you've studied QED, I assume, in your courses. So the other problem is that the thing that we can compute is thus far only the absorptive, or in quotation marks, the imaginary parts. The quotation marks are needed because we don't really know what the phase conventions on the external states are. The other thing is that so far we're just looking at some particular channel. If I say, oh, I want the discontinuity in this particular channel, then you can go off and grind away at that integral and eventually come up with some formula. So the amplitude has many channels, and so far we're only looking at one. Okay, so the next step is to think about, again, we don't want to actually do calculations with Feynman diagrams, but they're a tool we can use as long as we're doing the calculation in the abstract, imagining that we're calculating all possible diagrams. So imagine that we do a Gedanken calculation of some particular amplitude, the amplitude with whatever number of external legs that are there. And now let's imagine, instead of looking at the discontinuity of a single diagram, we're going to look at discontinuity still in this channel k squared of some one loop amplitude. Well, we know in the abstract how to do this. We write this as the discontinuity of the sum of all one loop diagrams, Feynman diagrams, that contribute to this amplitude. And because it's a summation and there's nothing, it's a finite sum, in fact, then there's, this is maybe one of the few mathematically rigorous steps we're going to do all week. We can move the discontinuity through, and now we're actually summing the discontinuity of a bunch of Feynman diagrams. So there's one issue we have to confront already, because the Kutkowski rules tell us to cut propagators that are surrounding K. But not every diagram has these propagators. In particular, we might, if you're thinking about Yang-Mills, for example, you might have a situation where, let's say, momentum A and A minus 1 are joined together in a four-point vertex. There's no propagator there to cut. So what are we supposed to do? Well, what we're supposed to do is actually pretty simple. We multiply by unity in the form L squared minus M squared divided by L squared minus M squared. And now this object has a propagator. Let's ignore the numerator for a second. And so we can go ahead and cut it, and of course, what you know is that this is just going to give us zero. It's just x delta x written out in a slightly more complicated setting. And that's also a hint of how this method is really going to work, how we're going to be able to get off-shell information from on-shell information. Well, the one side of that is, you know, is off-shell information going to obstruct what we're doing here? And this is really the same as the fate of off-shell information. If you imagine having some complicated numerator that you might get out of a gauge theory, and again, this is kind of symbolic, you'd have to, or heuristic, you'd have to write it out a little bit more carefully. But you can imagine doing an on-shell expansion. So this is the term that's actually going to survive. And then symbolically, you'd have various powers if you're going off-shell. It's a little bit more complicated because there's a number of multiple directions you can go off-shell. But so this is p going from 0 and up. And then there's going to be some kind of derivative of the function taken around the on-shell limit. And again, these terms are going to suffer the same fate as the terms that have no propagator. They're just going to go away. So now what we can do is we can write a slightly modified formula for our amplitude. It's the sum of all diagrams. So it's the sum over one loop diagrams that have both propagators surrounding K. And that's actually the key, one of the key observations, and that's something which we'll be generalizing as we go on later. And this thing, because it has these propagators, it's actually also very crisp. We can separate each of the diagrams into a left part and a right part in a very clean way. So if we now sum over it, we now have our integral over phase space, the sum, which is a sum over all diagrams. So if we think about it, we have, for a fixed right-hand side in a given one-loop diagram, we have all possible left-hand sides. And likewise, we then have to iterate over all the possible right-hand sides. And the only things that might sort of give us trouble are precisely the things that go away. So our sum, we can now write in terms of all the left side tree diagrams. And let's see here. Let me label this F sub L. And then we have all the right-hand tree diagrams, F sub R. So in fact, the formula that we have is now an integral over not just a tree diagram, but a tree amplitude on the left and a tree amplitude on the right. And that's good. I mean, we haven't, neither Song nor I have shown you in any concrete detail how much simpler the amplitudes are than the collection of Feynman diagrams, but just looking, for example, at the Park-Taylor formula, you can see that there the growth of the number of terms is linear in n versus some factorial number of diagrams. And indeed, in general, the basic problem with Feynman diagrams is that there are enormous cancellations in gauge theory, so that the amount of information that's contained in any given diagram is almost nothing. It's in fact factorially small once you get to a large number of external legs. But we can avoid all of that. We have various efficient techniques and we have compact representations. So now we can go and do that directly. Yes.
About this comment. So do we know that the information is not really concentrated in some subset of diagrams?
Yes.
And all the rest somehow constantly covered? Do we know that the
concentration is really... Yes. Yes, you do. You do. People actually, a long time ago, people thought about trying to compute amplitudes by Monte Carlo. And because of all these cancellations, that's a frightfully, factorially frightfully bad idea, because all you get is noise. Because the convergence of Monte Carlo is relatively slow, but in fact, almost any algorithm you'd have would be terrible, because you'd need an algorithm that was factorially convergent, and I at least don't know of any such algorithms. So, at this point, we have solved one of the problems, and you can compute this by on-shell recursion, or by other techniques, or by looking up the answers in a book, whatever way seems best for the problem at hand, but you're going to start with relatively compact formula. In fact, you can even imagine, as we'll see, doing that computation numerically. So now the idea is that we want to run this whole process backwards. So we want to start from our tree amplitudes. We're going to form the phase space integrals. And we kind of know what's happening, where those phase space integrals came from. They came from a loop integral. How we go from the loop integral? Well, we take our phase space measure, which you're probably more used to seeing it in a form where you have a d cubed p divided by twice the energy of p times 2 pi cubed. But you can go back and put in all these delta functions. And then you can say, aha, I know where those delta functions really came from. They came from a propagator. So we promote our phase space integral back to a loop integral. And it will have this form. We'll have, again, I apologize for not really keeping track of the factors of I in the propagators. Obviously, if you're doing a real calculation, you'd better worry about that. So this is the object that we have. And I want to emphasize that we're not going back and computing some off-shell tree amplitude. These are really the on-shell tree amplitudes. And there's a slight mismatch here, but that slight mismatch, as we saw just a few minutes ago, is not going to affect the result for the discontinuity in the given channel. So this thing in general has some numerator that does depend on L. You have to do some algebra, and you'll be able to ultimately reduce it. One of the issues is that, of course, you're not done yet, because you have to sum over all the different channels. I dropped the masses because I'm being sneaky. But if you were doing massive theories, then you'd have the masses in here. But in fact, that is very much anticipating my next point, which is that we want to go to a theory with massless particles. So now we're going to think about the case. So the problem is that this expression is actually ill-defined. And the reason for that is that we have all sorts of divergences. Before we talk about that a little bit, we may not have the complete dispersive parts, but now we really do have a loop integral. So along with our absorptive parts in this channel, we also have some amount of dispersive parts. So we're not completely afflicted by that anymore. So what's the basic problem with massless particles in gauge theories? Well, you can think about it if you're trying to compute, for example, the production, some scattering process in QED. You're trying to compute the amplitude or the cross-section for producing an isolated electron. So does anyone actually know what the answer for that kind of a computation would be? Did you not study the Bloch Nordsig, all that in your field theory course? How many people studied it in their field theory course? My goodness, standards have really fallen. So the problem is that cross-section is actually zero. And the reason is that you cannot divorce the electron completely from its radiation field. And it's not really a very sensible physical question to ask, because the question you should be asking is, what's the cross-section for finding an electron and up to some amount of soft photon energy? Because if the photon is soft enough, you're not actually going to be able to detect it. So you can't distinguish those states, the states that have an electron and one very soft photon, or maybe two soft photons, or anyway, some amount of energy in soft photons, you can't distinguish it from a bare electron. Well, zero or non-zero, that doesn't seem like such a big deal. The problem is that if you compute those amplitudes order by order in perturbation theory, what you actually find is something much more disturbing than zero. You'll find infinity. And that infinity reflects a logarithmic divergence. And in fact, when you resum all those infinities, then you get Sudikoff factors. And if you take the energy cutoff to zero, then in fact, you'll get zero again, which is the correct answer. And those infrared divergences, we may have time tomorrow to come back and look at them in a little bit more, but for the moment, you should just be aware that they're there and they're associated basically in the case of QCD with gluons becoming very soft, and then the kind of phase space integrals you're going to encounter are going to have this form. And there is also collinear singularities that are associated with two gluons becoming very collinear, or a quark and massless quark and anti-quark pair becoming very collinear. And those are ultimately giving rise to integrals of this sort. Again, you need some kind of lower cutoff. And we saw that really on the first day, on Monday. That's, in a sense, what the role of the JET algorithm is doing, is that it's saying, well, in a fixed order calculation, I'm really only integrating down to the JET radius. It's of course a little bit more complicated because of the structure of the algorithm, but that's heuristically what it's telling you. So in the real world, that is in the practical world of theoretical calculations, then the only way you really can do this and keep your sanity is to have a regulator. And the regulator that is practical is a dimensional regularization. So what I'm actually going to do here is simply promote this four-dimensional integral to a d-dimensional integral. And then, in fact, these expressions are now well-defined. The infrared divergences are reflected in the appearance of poles in epsilon. So generically, at one loop, there'll be some function divided by epsilon squared, and then there'll be some other function divided by epsilon, and then there'll be some other final function which has no powers of epsilon and is finite. So at the end of the day, when one constructs a physical quantity, all these various 1 over epsilons have to cancel, but they cancel in a very complicated way between the parton distributions, between real emission of gluons. Again, the virtual and the real emissions will cancel the singularities, and what you'll be left with, of course, is something that should have only an order epsilon to the zero contribution. So it's actually the infrared divergences that are the more complicated and serious ones. Those are the ones that show up in the 1 over epsilon squared. The 1 over epsilon involves both ultraviolet and infrared divergences, but again, the structure of ultraviolet divergences, certainly at low loop order, is actually relatively simple. So this is working here again. I should have written this down first, in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. And epsilon, of course, depending on whether you're trying to focus on the infrared or the ultraviolet divergences, epsilon has to be taken to be negative or positive. So we're going to look at these numerators, and we're going to do the integral reductions, and then that's going to, and for those of you who have not seen the whole structure of integral reductions or have forgotten it, we're going to review that in a little while. But for the moment, you can imagine simplifying these integrals, so now you have some sum of Feynman integrals. You're going to retain only those integrals, only the integrals that actually have a discontinuity in the k squared channel. And then you're going to sum over channels, but you're not just going to blindly sum over all the different channels, because they're going to be integrals that have discontinuities in multiple channels. So as an example, if you're starting with some four-point integral, and we'll see the kinds, more precisely the kinds of integrals that you ultimately get again in a little while. As you're doing these algebraic reductions, let's suppose we have an S channel here and a T channel. We're looking at some contribution here. And we might get bubble integrals that, and we're looking at the discontinuity in the S channel, we might get bubble integrals out of the integral reduction that are in the T channel. These don't have a discontinuity in the S channel, so in this particular cut, we're going to throw them away. Also, if we now later go and do the T channel, then of course this integral we're going to retain there, but we're going to retain him, of course, once. On the other hand, this box integral will have discontinuities in two channels, so we're only going to keep one copy of him. And if you like, if you're doing it this way, then there's actually a consistency check, because you have to get the same coefficient in both channels. That's one of the elementary consistency conditions. So we're merging rather than summing. And this procedure is what you might call version one of the unitarity method. We're not actually going to do any examples here, but this is a method that was practical and was used for a lot of calculations in the 1990s and early 2000s. So we now have a way of dealing with all the channels, and we also understand how to deal with massless particles. On the other hand, there is this annoying fact that we have to do reductions of our integrand, and that's something that we really have to do analytically. It's something you can't imagine doing purely numerically, and it's also a little bit of a hassle. It seems that there's maybe some extra work that we don't really need to do. But if you're doing analytic calculations, then this is, in fact, good enough. And as I said, it was used for many calculations. Many of the classic calculations were done this way. So this is kind of the conceptual underpinnings. We've gone from unitarity to looking at sets of diagrams that have two propagators surrounding a given channel, and then that breaks them apart into tree amplitudes. So we're looking at, and then we're reassembling those tree amplitudes and doing some algebra and getting some coefficients times some Feynman integrals. So one can sort of do it this way, but it's better to actually organize the calculation in terms of what I call a master equation. And the next thing we're going to do is derive that master equation and understand how it emerges. And then we'll come back and look at generalized unitarity and see how to compute all the ingredients in that master equation. So again, we have an underlying field theory, and let's make use of that. Again, let's imagine doing some Gedanken calculation of some one-loop amplitude. So again, the shading here indicates the sum over all Feynman diagrams, and the whole is not a donut. It's just an indication that we're working at one loop. So let's imagine we're looking at some endpoint amplitude. And we imagine writing down all possible Feynman diagrams. And let's focus not so much on the vertices and on the on the numerators, but let's ask, what are the integrals that can arise? Well, we know that we're going to have integrals that have, where all the external gluons are attached directly to the loop via three-point vertices. And everything else is actually going to be an integral that has fewer propagators, because we're going to have some trees that are attached to a loop, or we're going to collapse some propagators and get four-point vertices, so on and so forth. So this is actually the most complicated integral that we're going to get. Let's write it down in dimensional regularization, as we know we should be doing. And we have the propagators. Which go around the loop. Again, all the legs, of course, now are massless. So each of these three-point vertices is, of course, linear in the momentum, but it has different terms in it. So it has terms where the momentum might be coming from the outside, and it also has terms where the momentum might be the loop momentum. And in the worst case, we're going to have each of these vertices producing a loop integral, and it's going to be contracted into something. But again, let's just focus on the loop for a second. So we're going to have integrals that have up to n propagators. They're, of course, going to be integrals that have fewer propagators as well. And they might carry up to L powers of the loop momentum in the numerator. And they, of course, will also come with fewer. So these loop momenta are contracted into external vectors. Which I'm going to write in this form. And those external vectors, they might be things like polarization vectors. They might be things like external momenta. If we start to put in fermions, they might be spinner strings. All of these objects we are going to take strictly to be in four dimensions. So on the inside, we have virtual particles, and we have divergences and intermediate stages, which we need to regulate. So we have to go to d dimensions. But on the outside, at least in the loop calculation, we're not interested in doing that. We're really interested in observing things in four dimensions. Someday, if the LHC discovers extra dimensions and people learn how to build really minuscule collider detectors that can go into those extra dimensions, we can change it. But for the moment, that's what we're going to do. This is sometimes where the potentially singular momenta are dimensionally continued, and where the observed momenta are left in four dimensions is known as the Tuft-Veltman scheme. And you may think of dimensional regularization as a single scheme, but in fact, there are many, many different flavors of it, and they vary in a lot of the details. What used to be the kind of canonical scheme and is still called conventional dimensional regularization would have also continued these into D dimensions. So the object that we really need to calculate is something that has this form. There's some vector V. There's a collection of vectors VI, some of which might be the same or they might not be. We don't really care for these purposes. And these things are all four in four dimensions. Loop momentum is taken to be in D dimensions. So in principle, we could just do this integral. We could do a Feynman parameterization. Do people remember how to do that? Okay. I won't verify that by calling anyone to the board to ask them to do an example. And then we could do the loop integral. And we could do the Feynman parameter integrals. Since this is all an abstract calculation, all of this is free. And at one loop, we would ultimately get expressions in terms of logarithms and dialogues. So, however, I mean, other than the fact we have some huge explosion of integrals, well, with computing, let's say if we're doing a four-point function, which was a heroic calculation when it was done by the old technology in the late 1980s. Today, it's probably not so painful just to do it by brute force, thanks to various utilities. But still, there's the underlying fact that analysis is hard. And algebra is easy. So you want to do as little analysis as possible and transform as much of it as possible into algebra. So what we want is to have, in this context, is to find algebraic relations as many algebraic relations as possible between integrals. And as pressing as this is at one loop, it becomes much, much more so when you go to higher loops. So it's a good start to look at this at one loop, where all the erasers are going. So the first step is that we want to expand these external vectors in terms of the external momenta of the given integral. Now we're working in four dimensions, so we know that any set of four independent vectors will serve as a basis. So let's write some chosen external vector in terms of coefficients over some set of external momenta. And the key thing, though, is to choose them to be momenta that appear in the denominator, or I should say the external momenta of the original diagram. So now we can write down an explicit formula for omega. It may be familiar to some of you. And to do that, it's convenient to introduce an object called a Gram determinant. So it's defined in terms of two sets of momenta, which I'm writing here as the upper and lower indices. They're not, they might or might not be massless. It doesn't really matter. The definition of the Gram determinant is general. And it's simply a determinant. You form all the dot products of the two different sets of momenta. That gives you a square matrix, and then you take its determinant. The normalization you may find in the older literature is different. It doesn't necessarily have this factor of two, but if you're working with spinners, then it happens to be convenient to do it this way. So one of the things that's useful about the Gram determinant is that if one of the upper momenta is proportional to another one, or likewise, one of the lower momentum is proportional to another, then the Gram determinant vanishes. So it's a way of measuring the collinearity or the of two different momenta or of combinations of momenta. Obviously, if you have a linear relation, then that's essentially the same as two being proportional. And in the case that it isn't and you have the maximal dimensionality, it's somehow measuring a kind of volume of the parallel piped that's enclosed by the four momenta. That's maybe not so intuitive in Minkowski space, but in any event. And then we can write down a formula for this omega j, excuse me, that has the following form, where we replace, it's the same, these again, the indices here indicate the momenta, just as we were doing with the spinner products, and where we substitute the jth momentum by the external vector, and then we normalize by another Gram determinant. When there's only one set of arguments, then it means that the upper and lower strings are the same. So G1234 is just a shorthand way of writing 1234 in the upper and lower rows. And using this property, it's easy to convince yourself that that's the correct formula. We also want to introduce a little bit of notation for integrals that make our life easier, or at least avoid my having to write the same thing a lot of times over on the board and you guys having to write a lot of the same stuff over and over again in your notes. So we're going to be considering, in fact, different numerators, because we have integrals that have a lot of different numerators. They've started with different tensors, and they'll be multiplied by different functions, different polynomials in the external invariants. So n we'll use to denote the number of external legs, or equivalently the number of propagators. And we'll introduce this bracket notation. Implicitly, this integral is a function of the external momenta. That I'm leaving implicit here. I'm not going to write out explicitly. But we introduce this notation of a polynomial in L, and that we want to denote. And again, it can implicitly be a function of external kinematics as well. It's just saying that we put that polynomial in the numerator, and of course we have the standard denominators, all the propagators. Okay. So we've now taken an arbitrary external vector and we've written it in terms of the external momenta. So all those dot products are now dot products of the loop momentum with one of the external momenta. Well, let's consider the case that we have an integral that involves L dot K2, for example. Well, we can just do a little bit of algebra, and we can write this just algebra in the numerator. We don't even know that it has anything to do with an integral. We can simply write it as a linear combination of some of the denominators that appear and also an external invariant, which is independent of the loop momentum. Well, the presence of dimensional regularization ensures that, in fact, all the integrals are, in a certain physicist sense, convergent. So we can simply split these terms apart. And I can cancel these factors, the factors that are propagators. And that's essentially going to pinch two legs together. So I'm going to get an n-point one, n minus one point integral. In this particular case, it's where legs k1 and k2 are combined. And from the second term, I'm going to get another such n minus one point integral, but a different one, one where legs k2 and k3 are combined. And finally, then I'm going to get a term which is still an n point integral, but it has a lower power of the loop momentum. It just has a constant in the numerator instead of a linear polynomial in the loop momentum. So what we've done here is we've taken an n-point integral, which has a rank j, that let's say it started out with some rank, some number of copies of the loop momentum dotted into external momenta, and we've reduced it to a combination of n minus one point integrals, at the same time also reducing the rank of rank j minus one, along with an n point integral, which also has lower rank. So it has fewer powers of the loop momentum. Well, of course, we know exactly what we love to do. We're just going to iterate this. At every step, we're going to want to expand in the external momenta of that particular integral. So we don't want to expand in terms of, in this integral, we don't want to expand in terms of k2 anymore. We want to expand in terms of k1 plus k2, and then k3 and k4, and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, what's going to happen is that we're going to get down to going to get down to a smaller collection of integrals. In fact, you can see that as long as the integral has four independent external legs, then we're going to be able to get rid of all the tensor integrals. Four independent external legs means five or more legs, because the momentum conservation is always going to make one of the momenta dependent on the other. And there, we're only, at this stage, we're going to be left with scalar integrals. So we have scalar integrals that, where we have, because we started with less than or equal to n external legs, we're still going to have up to n external legs. And we're going to be left with some integrals with numerators, non-trivial numerators. That have up to four external legs, because there we run out of external momenta in which to do an expansion. Okay, so now we want some more algebraic identities. We'd like to get rid of some of these higher point scalar integrals, and we can go back to our friend the Gram determinant, and we can define the following Gram determinant. Let's take the loop momentum. We have, since we're looking at more than four external legs, or actually let's look, in fact, at more than five external legs, then we can write down a Gram determinant of this form. If we had five external legs, then this thing is actually trivially zero, because the five momenta are not linearly independent, and so I can, for example, write five as a linear combination of the other four, and then every single term there will have a repeated momentum, and so the Gram determinant will vanish. But if I have six or more external legs, then it's not trivially vanishing. Nonetheless, I'm still working in four dimensions. Remember, the external vectors we're all keeping in four dimensions, so this thing is going to vanish. It's not going to vanish by expanding the determinant and looking at it in Mathematica, but if you evaluate it numerically, for example, you'll see that's true. And that statement is true because of the lower line, independent of the fact that L is in D dimensions. So if I had two D-dimensional vectors here, that wouldn't be true anymore. In fact, there'd be no number, finite number of vectors I could add that would make the thing vanish. So we can now consider the following integral. So again, let's put this thing in the numerator. We know that this thing is zero. But of course, all the dot products that arise here, we're going to take every term is going to be proportional either to L dot K1, L dot K2, and so on and so forth. Each one of those, we can run our reduction procedure. And when all the dust settles, what's going to happen is that we're going to find an equation for the scalar six-point integral in terms of some sum of five-point integrals. Actually, let me, so there's some coefficients, and then there's different five-point integrals that can arise from pinching the different legs. So the polynomial argument is one, and then the momentum arguments are different. And similarly, if n is greater than six, you can again solve for the endpoint integrals in terms of a collection of five-point integrals. So at this point, we're down to scalar integrals that have five or fewer legs. And that's already good, because that says that no matter how many external legs we started out with, we have some self-contained finite basis of integrals to worry about. What about the five-point integral? Well, as I said, we can't, this Gram determinant simply vanishes identically, so it's really not very useful. But we can consider maybe the next simplest thing, which is the following Gram determinant. So let me actually take the upper line and repeat it. So this object is not zero, because L is a d-dimensional vector. On the other hand, L is pretty close to four-dimensional, right? It's only epsilon away from four dimensions. if L were actually a four-dimensional vector, then this thing would vanish because it is five momenta, and then L would necessarily be some linear combination of the others. So, in fact, what's happening is that this object is, in a certain sense, of order epsilon. So you can imagine that if I consider putting this into the numerator of a five-point integral, that maybe something interesting happens. On the other hand, I've told you that there's a 1 over epsilon squared here, so the fact there's an epsilon doesn't quite go far enough in getting something useful. It turns out, and this I won't have time to explain, that this numerator insertion also gets rid of all the Gram determinants. So in fact, this integral is finite, and you get this order epsilon on top of it. So in fact, this integral turns out to be of order epsilon. So that's not a statement which you can really see easily from anything I've told you. So I'm just going to ask you to take it on faith. Now, if you think back to our writing out of the power series in epsilon, at least if we're doing next to leading order calculations, we don't actually care about stuff that's of order epsilon, because that stuff that in the tree level, so what we're going to do is we're going to compute a one-loop amplitude, we're going to interfere it with a tree, and then we're going to integrate that in a configuration, all configurations where all the gluons are well separated. So there's going to be no extra divergences that arise. And there, of course, the terms that are of order epsilon at the end of the day, once we've canceled all the infrared singularities, we're going to take epsilon to zero, they're simply going to vanish. So in fact, we can drop terms that are of order epsilon. And that in turn means that if we now consider the reduction of this thing, we're going to get this thing is in some sense of order epsilon. If we reduce the other side, we're going to find that there's a relation, in fact, between the five-point integral, the pentagon, and different box integrals, which I'll just label J over here. And this thing is of order epsilon, but epsilon for our purposes here is essentially as good as zero. This is not an epsilon you have to worry about canceling some divergence. It's really an overall epsilon in the final answer. So it's, for our purposes, we might as well set it to zero, and that means that our scalar pentagon we can now write in terms of box integrals. So now we're actually down to integrals that have up to four external legs. The only thing is we still do have these numerator insertions to worry about. But now we can make use of a technique that goes back, I would say over 60 years now, to Feynman and Brown, and was really done in kind of a systematic way by Passerino and Veltman. That's also not exactly yesterday's physics. So, for example, we can, even though we don't have enough basis vectors, then by using parity conservation, we can say that if we have, for example, a single insertion of the loop momentum in the numerator, we're going to be able to express this in terms of the external momenta. So this is the integral being expressed there, not the integrand. That's the difference, that at the higher points, we were able to express the integrand in this form here. It's only the final integral that we're able to express. So for example, we can choose some linearly independent combinate set of momenta, for example, legs 1, 2, and 4. And there's going to be some coefficients. Each of those coefficients is going to end up being proportional to the scalar box integral. We can do this for the box, the triangle, the bubble. If we're working in dimensional regularization and we have only massless particles, then there are no tadpole integrals because they simply vanish in dimensional regularization. They have no scale. So then we're actually done. And what we have is that we know that every amplitude can be expressed in terms of boxes, triangles, and bubbles. One thing I was not maybe completely careful about is that there can also be terms that appear in this reduction that are in fact entirely free of branch cuts that don't involve any integrals at all anymore. In some sense, that's because they're leftover parts of various things that are finite in epsilon. Now, as we're going through this reduction procedure, we started out with all the external momenta being massless, but we're pinching things together. So at lower, later stages of this reduction, the different external momenta of the integrals are now sums of the original momenta. So they can be, in general, massive. And for an endpoint amplitude, there's different configurations that we need to consider. So for example, there's the so-called one-mass box integral. We have to worry about two different configurations of the two-mass box integral. Where they're adjacent is sometimes called the hard two-mass box, and where they're, the two masses are at opposite corners is the easy two-mass box. There's a three-mass box. And four-mass box. Likewise, for the triangles, there you can have one-mass triangles. Two-mass triangles and three-mass triangles. And there's only one kind of bubble that you have to worry about. The if you're tempted to worry about bubbles that are massless, so bubbles on external lines, again, in dimensional regularization, those things will simply vanish. So there's nothing to worry about. So what that tells us is that we started with a general endpoint amplitude, and we now know that we can express that amplitude as a sum over a certain basis set. Of integrals, and the kinds of integrals that show up in the basis are precisely what we saw on the board above. So we have these integrals, and we know they're going to come with some coefficients. Those coefficients are in the process of this reduction. They're going to start out, of course, with polarization vectors of the external legs, and at the end of the day, those polarization vectors are going to be dotted into other external momenta, and there's going to be factors of these Gram determinants left lying around. We can use the spinner helicity basis. So what we know is that these things are going to be rational functions of our spinner variables. And in addition, there can be a rational term, which is something that arose, in some sense, from the detritus of the reduction procedure. Again, it's going to be rational in the spinner variables. So this is our key equation. And I can see already there won't really be time to do much with it today, but that will be our starting point, and we will understand generalized unitarity based on that equation tomorrow. Let me just make a few kind of comments about dimensional regularization. So there are really three roles that it's playing. It's serving as a UV regulator in the usual way. It's also serving, as I haven't explained, but I've alluded to, it's serving as an ultraviolet regulator. And the final role that it's playing is it's essentially giving you a handle, and again, not something I will have time, on these, on the rational terms. So the rational terms are a little bit disturbing from the point of view of the unitarity method because there's no branch cut here. So there's no discontinuity to latch on. And what's essentially happening from a conceptual point of view elsewhere is that you're picking out the branch cuts, the discontinuities in all these integrals, but because it came from a field theory, you know that those discontinuities come along with a very well-defined real part that's dictated by the Feynman integrals. But the rational terms don't quite fit in that paradigm. And there's really two ways to understand how dimensional regularization avoids this problem or solves this problem. One is that if you now go to order epsilon, so we've thrown away those terms, but if you in a certain metaphorical sense keep the order epsilon terms, then what you discover is that for dimensional reasons, you're going to have some minus s to the minus epsilon, and that's in a sense multiplying the rational terms as well. Of course, there you can set epsilon to zero, it just goes away. But if you do go to order epsilon, then you're going to get some log of minus the invariant. And this thing now, again, does have a branch cut, so it gives you something to latch onto and it, at least in principle, get the rational terms via unitarity. At a somewhat deeper level, the presence of the rational terms, if you think back to yesterday's lecture and the discussion at the very beginning about dispersion relations, I mentioned that they're subtractions that are rational functions that can arise, and they're connected with the ultraviolet behavior of the theory. So when you put in dimensional regularization, you make all the integrals convergent. So there's no more ultraviolet divergences. And so conceptually, you're getting rid of that subtraction constant. And that's related to the fact that it's giving you a handle on computing the rational terms. So I'm not really going to say more about those terms in these lectures, but just to reassure you that you do have a handle on them. So if you think back to our earlier discussion, remember I was emphasizing the fact that we were looking for all contributions which had a pair of propagators that surround a certain channel. And if we look at our integrals, then we can see that if we, these again have to, you have to look at all possible channels, so there's all possible combinations of momenta that you have to distribute over these. So if I look in some particular channel, I might, for example, find a cut here, might find a cut here, I might find a cut here, so on and so forth. So in any given channel, we'll have a lot of different integrals that will contribute. But if we look at these integrals, then we can see that they have different different choices of propagators. So for example, even though there's a cut over here, then there's a whole bunch of different four mass boxes that will have that cut. But this particular propagator will be special to only one of them, because if I move one leg from this massive leg to another, then that propagator will now be absent. So if I want to try and isolate a smaller number of integrals, then I should try and look at terms that have more propagators. In particular, let's imagine the very simplest thing you could do, which is instead of insisting that two propagators be present, you insist that three propagators be present. Well, the bubble only has two propagators, so we would get rid of him. And each triangle is uniquely specified now by the sets of propagators, by the three propagators that you're insisting on. So instead of, for example, having some ambiguity, let's say if we were cutting this channel, then you could have both one mass and two mass propagators, two mass triangles. If I now insist on cutting this leg as well, then all of a sudden I've really isolated this particular triangle. So the goal of what we want to do is, as we'll see next time, is we're going to put on more cuts. That is, we're going to cut more than just two propagators. We're going to cut three propagators, or we're going to cut four propagators. We're going to apply that on both sides of the master equation, and then we're going to use that to derive equations for the coefficients of the integrals. So, and this is going from cutting two propagators to more propagators is known as generalized unitarity. Why it's called generalized is very clear. People discussed these ideas in the 1960s when S-matrix theory was all the vogue, but the truth is there's no real unitarity interpretation of doing this thing. So the reason it's called generalized unitarity as opposed to something else is because of the connection to unitarity through cutting fewer propagators. Now, each cut is essentially imposing a delta function on replacing a propagator by a delta function. It's imposing a constraint on the loop momentum. And we have d dimensions, but let's forget about the epsilon for a second. It's kind of really there just to regulate all sorts of divergences. Really, we kind of have four components of the loop momentum. So we can imagine that we can impose four conditions. And that would say that actually we can go back, we can go further than just cutting three lines. We can go as far as cutting four lines. And that's, if we do that, then we've picked out a specific box. We've gotten rid of all of the triangles, we've gotten rid of the bubbles, because every box integral is uniquely specified by the four propagators. If I choose some other set of propagators, it's equivalent to moving some of the original massless external lines from one of these legs to another. Clearly, at one loop, I can't do more than that. I can't cut five lines. I can't cut five propagators because none of my bases has five propagators. Well, I could do it, but I would get an equation that says 0 equals 0. And 0 equals 0 is true, but it's not very useful. So what we're going to start with tomorrow is the idea of not just doing an ordinary unitarity cut, but doing a so-called quadruple cut, cutting four propagators, and then we'll see how to derive some useful results from that. So let me stop here. Are there any questions? Okay, if not, then I'll let our organizer...